Godzilla.
When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr. With me, as always, is Brian Reese.
Here I am. Good to be with you, Paul.
Good to be with you as well. Today on the program, we will be discussing the very interesting run of Godzilla, King of the Monsters.
I think this counts as infamous.
Is it infamous? Well, we'll decide that. We'll hash that out. But we're going to do Godzilla, King of the Monsters from the 1970s Marvel stock of stuff. Okay. But before that, we're going to discuss... We don't really have news to talk about this time around, or at least news we want to talk about. Let's put it that way. So we're going to try to discuss, or at least, I guess not discuss, but more reminisce about some of the ads you would find in 1970s comics. Now, Brian, you're an older fella like me.
I'm a man of a certain age.
That's right. I assume you remember some of the more interesting ads that were in comic books back in the day.
Gee willikers, Paul.
Yes.
Some of the ads were like I remember looking forward to the ads. I'd pore over them. You know, you'd get that full page of
just the little squares.
Just the little squares, and you'd be squinting at them, and just what is this one selling? What is this one? And you know, boy, it'd be kind of fun if that. I was gonna say, wouldn't it be fun if they did those again? But probably not, because there's probably some legal issues with some of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting the way it was marketed to media that was ostensibly for children, and of course, the most infamous one is probably the X-ray vision glasses.
The X-ray vision glasses, see through people's clothes. Wait a minute.
Exactly. There was always a little illustration of a guy looking at a woman, and you could see through her clothes.
Yeah, like, really? And of course, that he had his eyes like in the glasses. There were like those circles, you know, like
exactly. Yeah, I mean, but because that's of course the first thing you want to do if you have X-ray vision is to see somebody naked. There was other things as well. I mean, you could get the switchblade comb.
The switchblade comb was good. I was particularly so. I didn't have any money as a kid. You know, what money I had went to buying comics, not stuff in the ads. But the one I always wanted, I wanted the ad with you know, 5,000 piece army action set or whatever it was with all the army men.
I knew someone who got that actually. Not me, but a friend of mine who lived on my block back in Philly got that. And it was the cheapest piece of crap you ever saw. Yes, you did get, you know, hundreds of these little army men, but they were like wafer thin plastic. It was like getting like a sticker. like that thin.
Yeah, it wasn't like the more solid army guys that we had.
Yeah, not the kind you see on Toy Story. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I remember just how disappointed his name was Rob. I remember how disappointed Rob was. Was like, I got gypped. Yeah, you did.
This cost me $4.
Yeah. A little story about myself. I actually did send away for a box of seeds, like flower seeds, because it said in the ad that you could make anywhere from $5 to $20 a week with it.
With a packet of seeds.
Yeah, by selling these seeds. And I was all about it. I was Mr. Entrepreneur at this point. I was going to make myself a little mini business. And it didn't turn out the way that I thought it would.
I'm surprised to hear that.
Yeah. I got a couple of mercy sales to my parents and some family members. But I didn't become independently wealthy because of that.
Did you go door to door?
I did try it. But I was all gung-ho when they first arrived. And I did try to go door to door. But no one was taking. I
mean, I think they took some seeds.
Yeah. Yeah. Hello, mister. Want to buy some seeds from me? Gee whiz, golly.
Say, pally.
Yeah. I gave up on that pretty quickly and was kind of.
Well, you know, what you should have done, Paul, is you should have gone, you know, the grit route.
I know. I should have sold grit. Grit was, of course, a newspaper from, God, it was started back in the 40s, It was around for a long time.
Yeah, when I've read some old comics, you would still, there would be grit advertisements in those.
Right. Like even like Golden Age stuff sell grit.
Yeah. But you know, you could, what was the ad? You could make $5-$10 a week.
A week.
Yeah.
A week. But you know, if I was making $5 a week at that time, I would have loved every, I would have considered myself a millionaire at that point.
Yeah. But you know, it makes you wonder, like, so if anybody out there listening to this sold grit, we would love to hear your story.
Absolutely.
To be featured on a future podcast. But, you know, part of me, you know, because you got a little bag, right?
Yeah.
Advertise, you got a little burlap bag or whatever that you could carry your grit in. I mean, you know, everybody needs something to carry their grit in. You know, I lived in a rural area, so I don't think, you know, I mean, if I was going to walk around my neighborhood trying to sell grit, I, you know, be spending 3 hours a night, you know, just to, but part of me also, like, didn't people have paper route? It was basically a paper route.
Yes, it was. It was a paper route for a paper nobody wanted.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how Brian K. Vaughan didn't jump on the grit bandwagon when he was doing Paper Girls.
Oh, yeah. I remember an episode of Mystery Science Theater from many years ago where Crow T. Robot, was selling grit, but they opened up his bag and it was just like sand. And they said, oh no, this is true grit.
But what were some of the other like great, so of course, Sea Monkeys,
which did not look like they did in the pictures.
No, apparently not. I mean,
no, they, you know, they weren't little pink people that lived in a castle and had crowns. I'm kind of shocked by that. There was always the ones where you could, you know, become a muscular man without exercising. All you had to do was...
Oh, yeah, like the famous, you know, cartoon with the guy getting the sand kicked in his face.
Right.
You know, and then eventually he goes on to become Flex Mentallo.
Which is great.
Right. But
that's exactly where that came from.
But, you know, I mean, some of those little, you know, it was lots of gags. Like it was the thing where you'd stick your finger in and it would look like you cut your finger off.
Yes. And of course, Joy Buzzers and
the gum.
Oh, yes. Oh, like yeah.
The trick gum. You got like three different kinds of trick gum, you know, and they'd advertise hours worth of fun. I was like, I don't know
about hours.
You know, it makes you wonder, like some of these, like, I was wondering who's ordering these?
Yeah.
I mean, people must have. I mean, there's on my route to work every day, I pass an old, what looks like it's a novelty toy factory. It's something else now, but the original sign is still on it. I can't remember. I wish I could remember what it was called, but I see it every once in a while on my way to work, you know, here in Chicago. And it's, I was like, you know, this is one of those places that were probably advertising their little schlocky, you know, toys, these cheap plastic toys that they were selling in comic books.
Oh yeah. You know, Joy Buzzers and snakes and cans, your fake poop and vomit.
Oh, right. Yeah. The squirting flower pin or whatever.
I used to have, it looked like.
Clearly the Joker was reading the ad pages in comics.
Yep. Absolutely. I used to have, it was a joke. It was like a packet of gum.
Mm-hmm.
One of the long rectangular looking packets of gum. And when someone tried to pull a piece out, it had a little mini mouse trap that would snap shut on your finger, which I thought was hilarious, but other people thought was painful.
Yes. Like, so many potential lawsuits.
I know. They sold that to children.
But all of these places also, like, you would send away your money to a P.O. box.
Yes. P.O. box in some random, you know, a town that no one's ever heard of before.
But you could also sign up for rush delivery for an extra 50 cents.
Because you had to have that, you know, squirting flour as soon as possible.
As soon as possible. But, you know, I just, I picture like a bunch of kids in like the 60s and 70s, you know, running around like a bunch of wiseacres, you know, with all their little trick pens and everything. Oh, what about the pen that if you turn it upside down, the person's clothes came off?
Yes. The little hula girl.
Right.
Yes. This is good stuff. I actually had many of these little items, not from the ads in comics, but there was a novelty store near where I grew up.
Right, right.
That I frequented quite a bit. It was a magic store. I'm putting magic in quotes.
Right, sure.
Yeah, it was cheap plastic stuff that I thought was amazing.
Well, there's still a couple holdovers here too, and like actual stores. Like there's a great store here called Uncle Fun. which
which you can get arrested for now.
Which you can, which skeevy name, but it's aside. It's there's great stuff in there, but you know they have like a lot of the retro kind of toys like that. So they're still being made.
Oh, places yeah,
are still making this stuff. I don't know if it's in Taiwan or you know where it is. You know, it's or you know Paducah or wherever. But yeah, it's you can still there are still places out there where you could pick up a lot of this stuff. I think most people now are just getting it for nostalgia or they make great stocking stuffers.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always going to be a market for cheap plastic novelty items.
But one of the other things, part of the reason we're talking about this is because obviously, like this comic, the Godzilla, there's a lot of ads, a lot of these ads sprinkled out through these comics that we're reading. And one of my other favorite things is all of the mailing list comic book companies.
Oh yeah, yeah. How did that work exactly?
Well, I think. This is the era we grew up. You'd think we would know this.
Yeah.
We sound like we're like 16-year-old kids going, how did that work?
Well, I had subscriptions to like directly from Marvel. Like
right, so did I.
Foreign. Yeah. But these other ads are you subscribe to this other company which would do it bundle them up for you.
Right, but also they would you know they were selling back issues.
Yeah.
These were like comic book stores in Virginia or in, oh, I don't know, say Denver, Colorado.
Yeah, Mile High
or
yeah.
Where have you, that they would just, you would send them money for, or, you know, a quarter for their mailing list. And what they would do is they just send you the list of all of their comics or whatever they're featuring, like back issue stuff. So you would order your back issues from like a mailing list that got sent to you once a month or every couple of weeks. You know, it's like, oh, yeah. I need Avengers number, you know, 63 and oh, you know, Bob's Comics in Wheeling, West Virginia on their mailing list, they have it available for 75 cents or a dollar and it's graded as whatever. I mean, that was very, you know, now you just go online. You could, all comic book stores, you could go online and order, you know, older issues of things, or you just go to your, if you're lucky to have a local comic store still available to you, you know, you just go look in their quarter bins or you go look in their.
Right, right.
But, you know, comic book stores weren't that prolific. The prolific's not there. There just weren't that many around. Like if you lived in an area that wasn't New York City.
Well, even, I think we've talked about this before. I mean, I grew up in Philadelphia, which is a big city. But even then, right. I just bought my comics at the local Wawa or Kmart off a spinner rack.
Right, yes. Yeah, yeah. The spinner racks, or for us, it was also, you know, because the local IGA had that, or Lawson's was our 7-Eleven
right
substitute. You know, Wednesday Comics wasn't so much a thing. You didn't know. You were just, you'd just go to the local, like you said, the Wawa or the Kmart or 7-Eleven or wherever, IGA, mm-hmm. and just hope that the comic, that your latest issue of X-Men for the month was there.
Exactly. Or you found the kid in the neighborhood who bought it and tried right. to- and try to trade for it, or, I don't know, rough them up. I'm from Philly. It's fine. That's what you did.
We were much nicer in the Midwest, Paul. We would just be like, hey, I got this comic. You got this comic. Let's go hang out. I'll read your comic, and you read my comic.
Ugh, I can't understand
yeah.
that.
Sharing.
No.
What is this sharing you speak of?
Hey, I like that comic. I would like to I would like to own that comic. You will give it to me now. Which is not true. We did share, and we traded comics like baseball cards.
Right.
Yeah.
Then you'd roll it up and stick it in your back pocket.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. That's the only way. That was the easiest way to transport comics.
Well, sure.
Via yeah. back pocket. It would always fall out when you're riding your bike and you'd have to brush it off.
Yeah. This issue of this comic that has this new character called Rocket Raccoon, that's not going to be worth anything. I'm just going to roll it up and stick it in my back pocket and have it hop on my bike and.
Exactly.
Oops, it fell in the mud. Oh, well, who's going to want this issue down the line anyway?
Seeing the future was never something that we took.
Yeah, we were the kids who opened our Star Wars figures and played with them.
That's right.
Somebody out there is shuddering.
And I didn't just stand it up on a shelf behind me for my YouTube video. Well, anyway, the ads back then were as integral to the comic as the story itself.
Oh yeah, they were as much a part of the experience.
Yes. as a follow-up to that seed story of mine, you know, I had to cut the page out in order to send in. So
yeah,
because there's always a coupon that you had to fill out. I was not only not saving my comics, I was defacing them as well.
Oh. Okay, not to make another Brian K. Vaughan reference, but I think it was Paper Girls or one of his other comics. He you could get stuff or there was something, but you actually had to cut out the thing in the new comic.
I don't remember that.
Someone will remember what that was, but I think there at some point Brian K. Vaughan was in one of his comics. I don't think it was Saga, because that seems particularly cruel. But,
Yes, indeed.
Saga. Does anybody remember Saga? That was a comic book that came out for a while.
All right. So ads and comics. Very cool. I don't think we have anything more to say, do we?
No. But hey, you know, people should send their stories.
Yeah.
Send in their stories and, you know, let us know your favorite comic book ad or if you have any experiences.
If you ordered anything or you wanted to be a grit salesman.
Right. Or if you were a grit salesman and got chased down the street by the local bullies.
Yeah, I'd love to hear that. All right.
Did you make $5 to $10 a week?
I know. Yeah. Did anyone make any money with this stuff? Because maybe I just didn't try hard enough to be the seed salesman I should have been. All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some 70s goodness.
And we're back. Paul Carr. Today, we are reading Godzilla, based on your recommendation. Would you like to tell us about it?
I sure would. There is a quote from a sacred religious text from the Cult of the Blue Oyster that states, "History shows again and again how nature points out the folly of man." This is, of course, in reference to Godzilla, the giant radioactive lizard native to Japan. And in many ways, it sums up today's comic. Godzilla first appeared in Toho's 1954 film, Gojira, which was originally intended as an allegory for nuclear destruction. The film is rightfully considered a classic. It's dark and poignant. It has a serious take on an issue that was and continues to be of utmost importance to our world. The film was well received and was a worldwide hit. And as you'd expect from something this serious and important, it was immediately turned into a franchise and made kid-friendly. So that, by the late 1970s, Godzilla was no longer a poignant metaphor for nuclear war, but a protector of Earth from aliens and monsters. And this is where the franchise was at when Marvel Comics obtained the rights in 1977. And thus, the comic Godzilla, King of the Monsters was born. This is a 24-issue run that ran from 1977 to 1979. And tasked with adapting this monster to comics was Doug Monk, with art, for the most part, by Herb Trimpe. As with all properties of Marvel at this time, Godzilla had to be incorporated into the larger Marvel universe. How exactly, you may ask, does a giant radioactive lizard fit into an established superhero world? The answer is, awkwardly. To add to the problem of adaptation, while Marvel still had the rights to Godzilla, they did not have the rights to use anything else. So no side characters, no monsters, not even any lore or reference to any of the now 2 decades worth of movies. Everything had to be made up from whole cloth, and the results are, to use a technical term, bonkers. The storyline is pretty simple. Godzilla shows up on the west coast of the US and begins to wreak havoc. All the while, he encounters various heroes from Marvel, the Champions, the Fantastic Four, the Avengers, etc. And he battles new and exciting kaiju like Batragon, Yetagar, and probably the most frightening of all, a sewer rat from New York. The narrative is helped along by the presence of S.H.I.E.L.D., led by the perpetually annoyed Dum-Dum Dugan, and an ally of sorts in Little Robbie Takaguchi, and his giant mecha robot, Red Ronin. Yum. Now, there are some series that seem absurd at the time, but when you look back on them, you find they are absolute classics of the genre. This is not one of them. But what Godzilla King of the Monsters is a testament to perseverance and creativity. Monk and Trimpe were given a ridiculous assignment: make a giant lizard part of an established superhero universe with very little to work with. And what they created was goofy and weird and silly and filled with lots of good-natured, tongue-in-cheek humor. The result, Godzilla King of the Monsters, is an oddity. It's harmless fun that seems as if the creators were having fun creating it. And sometimes, that's all that matters. Brian, what did you think of Godzilla, King of the Monsters?
It's comics!
Yes, absolutely.
My goodness. I think you summed it up pretty well. I think bonkers is an appropriate word. I mean, it borders on the so bad it's good. And again, I don't mean that as an insult to Monk or Trimpy or any of the other creators.
Yeah.
But the premise alone is it's ridiculous. It's completely absurd. But at the end of the day, it is fun.
Yeah. And I think that's all it was meant to be.
Right.
I've read an interview with Doug Monk, and he pretty much says straight out that he didn't want to do this. He was surprised that it was given to him, and he just, you know, just started throwing things at the wall and hoping that it stuck. And you can kind of see that, you know, the first four issues or so, they seem to be kind of stumbling around, kind of unsure what to do with the premise.
It's almost like they wanted to be more serious.
Right. And then finally they just said, the hell with it. You know, you can almost see the light bulb go off. Like suddenly the wackiness just amps up and the humor becomes more prevalent and the situations get weirder.
We need cowboys. We need...
Oh, let's send them to Las Vegas. Let's have them fight Bigfoot. Yeah. How about cattle rustlers? Want to fight some cattle rustlers? Sure. Why not? Let's do that. How about space? Let's send them to space. There is... It's issue number 7. I had to look at my notes. This is where I see the change happen. Because on the opening splash page, there's a little narration that says, setting, a military installation in North San Diego, recently equipped with an enormous escape-proof case. Situation, Godzilla escaped. And that's the kind of humor that just keeps getting reinforced after this.
Right.
You're like, that's just like, we're not going to take this seriously anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
And, not only does Godzilla escape, but the geniuses, of course, have Godzilla stored in an area where the largest stockpile of nuclear weapons also happens to be.
Yeah, of course. Yes. Always put giant radioactive lizards next to nuclear weapons. Makes perfect sense. Yeah. The back half of this series is really, I think, where it starts to hit its stride. That's where they're just throwing everything at it. But I suppose we should talk a little bit about, okay. So we're not going to talk about issue by issue. This is a 24 issue run and we're not going to talk about issue by issue, but there are sort of little mini arcs as this goes along. And I think we can talk about that in general terms.
Right.
And as I said, the first four issues are basically just Godzilla shows up, wreaks some havoc, and then storms off again. He destroys the San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge, because I think that's required of all giant monsters.
Right. He destroys Seattle.
He destroyed Seattle. Tries to have a little intimate relations with the Space Needle, which is neat. but those
Who
are the issues.
Has it?
That's right. Those issues are they're fun, but they, you know, I don't think that the team knew what they were doing just right then.
Right. The other things to bring up about these is there's some real darkness there too, because I mean, Godzilla's eating boats with people in them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's like a massive loss of life going on in these first few issues that is sort of swept under the carpet later.
Yeah, and it's tamped down a little bit because you start to see people getting away as it goes on. And they're trying to turn Godzilla into more of a hero type, right, instead of just a rampaging monster, which is what he started out as. Another notable cameo in the early issues is the presence of the Champions, which is everybody's favorite superhero team. There's serious sarcasm there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And and just the Champions being as incompetent as one would imagine.
Yes. Oh, man. You have Hercules, who's, yay, verily. He is, everybody's least favorite knockoff of Thor. Right.
And then Black Widow, because what you really want when taking on a large skyscraper-sized lizard is an espionage expert.
Yes.
With
yes.
no powers.
Yeah. Yeah. Could we get a gymnast in here? Because we have a giant monster. So those first four issues aside, it's the Dr. Demonicus arc where it really starts to pick up. Dr. Demonicus.
Dr. Demonicus.
Who did parody songs on the radio, I believe.
Very famous. He has lots of CDs about the parody songs.
Yes. Weird Al. Huge, huge fan.
Huge fan of Dr. Demonicus.
Dr. Demonicus. I guess they were trying to create a supervillain for Godzilla. Someone who could, a supervillain that creates other monsters, another kaiju.
Because they weren't allowed to use, right?
No, they weren't allowed to use.
So, Monk and Trippy had to create new, and some of their creations are, well, we'll get to that.
Yes. yes, indeed. No, they weren't allowed to use things like Mothra and Rodan and Ghidorah, like the most famous monsters from Godzilla's movies. So they had to create new stuff. But the Demonicus run, you start to get a little bit more of the wackiness and the silliness starting to come out of it. The big monster to come out of the Demonicus run is is Batragon.
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 Having trouble pronouncing that. I was like, is it Batragon?
Oh no,
is it Batragon?
You got to have years of watching kaiju films to know, to instinctively know how to pronounce these things.
Although, my favorite probably of this, which is another one of the monsters that Dr. Demonicus has, is, and I refuse to pronounce it other than Gila Ron.
Sure.
It's Ron, who's a Gila.
Yes, you could sing it to the tequila song. Yeah, but like I said, you can start to see that the wackiness starts to come in. The character of Dum Dum Dugan, who was from the very beginning being very gruff and kind of having some homespun, gosh darn it type of insults, slinging insults at people. It just gets dialed up to 11 in this storyline. Right.
Well, he becomes the Dan Rather of Marvel Comics. The Dan Rather of S.H.I.E.L.D.
That's
the wit and wisdom of Dum Dum Dugan.
Yep. Daggum doggone it. Yes. It's really
yay,
good. I love the fact that whenever someone mentions, there's another giant monster, and he's like, what are you, crazy? That doesn't happen. It's like, you're following Godzilla, for God's sakes. How is it your suspension of disbelief is just off the rails?
Throughout this entire run, it's basically like Dugan is just having the worst day ever, every day.
Oh, yeah. Every time something goes wrong, it's like, oh, geez, me and my big mouth. Like, why is this happening to me? It's so funny. He hates his job and his life. But after the Demonicus run, there's another, the next story arc. It has a couple of things where Godzilla gets captured in the giant behemoth helicarrier. Yeah, which is just basically a giant square with fans on the side of it.
Some of the ships and some of the tech, are just silly looking.
Yeah, this has a lot to do with Trimpy's art style,
right?
Yeah, and he's really hit or miss for me. You can look at the tech and the ships and things like that. He's really trying to emulate Kirby.
Yeah.
But he's not
Trimpy Kirby. Is no Kirby.
Yeah, he's... I know Kirby. I've read Kirby. You're no Kirby. That being said, his animals, Godzilla himself and some of the other creatures, he's really quite good at. There's some splash pages that are amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, he drew Hulk for many, many years. So he has that kind of, you know, giant muscular type of thing down pat. So it's, the art's back and forth for me. But anyway, in this, I'll call it the Yetigar arc. I mean, come on, Yetigar. So Godzilla gets captured, is held next to nuclear weapons, as you do.
As one does.
And meanwhile, some radiation gets out and turns a local Bigfoot into a giant Bigfoot, which Godzilla has to go fight the giant Bigfoot in the Grand Canyon.
And this is where Red Ronin comes into play.
Yum. That's another thing, though, because at this time, Marvel had the rights to do Shogun Warriors. There was a series about giant mecha robots called the Shogun Warriors, but they weren't allowed to do any crossover between the two. It's my understanding, anyway, that they wanted, that Trimpy and Monk wanted to use those Shonen Warriors as in this, but they couldn't. So they had to create a brand new one, which is Red Ronin.
Piloted by the young 10-year-old or however.
Little Rob. Little Rob Takaguchi. Yeah, I mean, come on. He breaks in, fries the circuit so that only he can use it. I mean, I think he should be put in timeout. Little Rob should.
Well,
but he's the human connection to Godzilla. He's sort of the champion that lets everyone know Godzilla's really a good guy. I mean, he might look like a giant monster stomping on people, but he doesn't mean it.
Well, and I think that's what's interesting is how throughout this comic there's this constant, this is a very Marvel thing too, and they're constantly trying to humanize Godzilla and create sympathy for Godzilla. Meanwhile, he's eating people but he's just misguided and scared.
Yeah. In the movies in this period, Godzilla had morphed into the protector of Earth kind of a thing. So he went from this menacing metaphor of nuclear Holocaust into now he's a kid-friendly guy who saves people. And I think they were, the Marvel comics were trying to emulate that to a certain extent.
Right. But of course, anybody trying to, you know, have sympathy for him, you know, runs into the dumb Dugan treatment.
That's right. Well, that's, I'm blanking on his name right now. Dum-Dum's side.
Oh, Gabe Jones.
Gabe Jones is also the voice of reason that keeps trying to tell Dum-Dum to settle down and take it easy on Godzilla. There is a really cool illustration that Trimpy does of Red Ronin's blueprints, where it has like the cutaway to see what's inside.
Oh, right.
I love that stuff. You know, Kirby used to do that all the time. Like, what's in the Baxter Building? And it was always like a cutaway to see what all the floors were.
It was like, yeah.
Yeah. I love that stuff. But yeah, so Godzilla escapes his captivity and then goes to fight the Yetigar in the Grand Canyon. And there is a, how do I describe this? There's actually kind of a melancholy mood to this. Because there's two monsters fighting, but there's also river rafting going on. So there's people in danger. And then little Rob steals Red Ronin, and joins the fight to try to help, to try to settle things down, but ends up having to kill the Yetigar. And I thought that was kind of brutal. I mean, for something this fun and silly, it was kind of tragic at the end.
Well, yeah, and he expresses a lot of guilt about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a 70s comic. Nothing is understated or subtle. So if he's feeling guilt, he will tell you in long, excruciating detail.
Long exposition.
Yes. It was, I'm not going to say touching, but it did make me go, oh, poor Yetigar. Well,
but there's a couple other moments. Even before this, there's at one point Godzilla ends up in Las Vegas, as one does. There's this whole weird subplot about, you know, this guy, his Winslow Bennett, who just keeps gambling because he has to save his mom's life.
Right.
So, you know, he's the perennial loser, and he's down to his last dime, and
Well, should he make a call to his family or should he put it in the slot machine?
Puts in the slot machine, wins some money, goes and wins some more money at another table. And then Godzilla comes along and destroys the flood. I forget, it's the flood from the dam comes in. And he loses all his money and he uses his last dime to call his wife and say, I've lost all the money, you know, but I have one dime left. So I'm going to try to get money to help cure my mom. And, you know, his wife's on the phone like, your mom died 3 years ago.
Right.
And then he just goes wandering off in the desert. What in the world?
I thought that was a really neat story. Incredibly weird and incredibly strange. But the way that it's told, it doesn't make any sense. But the way that it's told, it parallels everything that Winslow is doing is paralleled by what Godzilla is doing. You know, obviously on a different scale.
Right.
But it's a very neat story.
But it's weird.
Yes, it is. I think this ties into the whole thing with Monk just saying, I don't care. Screw it. Let's just see if this works.
But you have this story, and then like going back to the Yetrogar battle and everything like that, and you have those rafters, and then there's this whole sub story about some of these rafters where the men are like criticizing the women for not being adventurous. And then the men get hurt and they have to walk it anyway. So the women turn the tables on them and they're like, you know, you're the weak ones, not us. And a wonderful sentiment. But what is this? This isn't about Godzilla.
I appreciate that, though. I love the strange, just bizarreness of the whole thing. I love the wife berating her husband. Get up, you wuss.
Yeah. I mean, it's great. Yeah. But it, you know, and this happens throughout the comic. There's just these weird things that you're like,
there's asides that just, you know, just happen seemingly random.
It's not like in a lot of Marvel comics where they'll introduce a weird scene that's setting up something for six issues down the line.
Things happen because why not? And speaking of things happen because why not?
I just wanted to insert real quickly before we move on. You started this with the introduction of the new helicarrier, the Behemoth. Right. And I do think it's important to point out that the pilot of the Behemoth, the Shield helicarrier, is a pipe-smoking mustache man named Hugh Howards.
Who wears a fedora. And I was going to ask you, does he take the pipe out of his mouth? Ever?
I don't know if it ever comes out. This shows how much fun he's having because he, you know, that Monk is having with the story at this point is because his name is Hugh Howards.
Everybody in S.H.I.E.L.D. has that, you know, tight fitting S.H.I.E.L.D. outfit with the holster and everything, except for Hugh, who has a fedora and a pipe and kind of casual dress.
I mean, it would be great if they revisit him later and, you know, he had become a hermit and his nails had grown long and he was, you know, being watched over by the Mormons or whatever. But
he wore tissue boxes on his
feet.
We
never get to revisit him later on.
The things we never got to see because this series was canceled. So, like I was saying, speaking of things that happen because why not, Godzilla then gets pulled into space by an alien race to fight. So there's two alien races. There are the Betas.
With the penis heads.
The Betas and the Megans. There's the planet Megan. And you know what? I hate Megan. They are the worst.
They are.
I mean, they bring up, they're constantly doing this war and it's just so rude. I hate Megan. I'm sure it's pronounced like Megan or something, but it's spelled M-E-G-A-N. It's Megan. Right. But Godzilla has to. Godzilla's brought into space to fight a monster on an asteroid, and the Betas decide that yes, he's going to be their champion. But lo and behold, the Megans, I hate the Megans. They send their monsters to Earth because why not? So Godzilla has to be transported back to Earth in order to fight the Megan monsters.
Ooh, seems suspiciously like the monsters from Dr. Demonicus.
Well, you know, I'm sure there's a catalog that they're getting all these from.
The Acme Monster Company.
Yes, but this is actually the turning point because during this fight, Dum Dum realizes that Godzilla is actually fighting for them and not against them, and actually saves Dum Dum's life.
Yes.
So So this is actually a very poignant moment in the run of Godzilla King of Monsters.
Poignant.
Yes, it's very poignant. Dum Dum has to come to the realization that maybe he was wrong. But don't tell him that, by gum.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't want to hear it.
Part of me kind of feels like there was a bit of a missed opportunity here, though.
How so?
I think, you know, we could have gotten like 6 issues of Godzilla in space.
Yes, it was. It did seem to end a little bit too quickly. We just had that one issue.
There's a great scene of him getting pulled off Earth through space. And, you know, here's Godzilla traveling through space. It's one of my favorite panels.
Yeah. Even the entire comic.
Godzilla just dippy-doo through space.
Yeah. Even the cover of that issue is just Godzilla floating through space with the Earth behind him. It's good stuff, man. Well, maybe if they had kept the rights, they would have revisited more space. So after Godzilla defeats the Megan monsters, Megan decides that she or that they really don't want to do war anymore because they've been shown the error of their ways.
Right, you know, because the betas were trying to end the war and the Megans were like the mean ones who were.
Yeah, they were the mean girls.
Right, they were the mean girls. And so just the fact that they're like, oh, I beat our monsters. I guess, you know, let's not.
Oh, well, let's just end the war.
But at some point, they also unleash some kind of destructive laser beam heading towards the Earth, right?
Well, yes.
And that never really resolves.
Well, once the monsters are destroyed, what's the point of using the laser beam, really?
But they already shot off the laser. You know, they had that lone Megan who was like flying a ship to Earth, and before the ship like fell apart, he got the laser beam off that was supposed to destroy a large part of the Earth, right?
Yeah. Wasn't that stopped by the SHIELD people?
I don't remember it. I think they just forgot.
There's no way of knowing. We can't look it up.
Once we've read it, it's done. We can't go back.
Exactly. I don't think it really matters. They just kind of like, it's all about Godzilla fighting bug monsters.
Right.
And
at some point we have to get to the cattle ranchers. So,
well, you know, that's next. Hold on. No, I just have my final thing on the space monsters is it's Dum Dum's running commentary on how they look. I'll get the googly-eyed one. You get the one with the antenna. And it's just so funny to hear him narrating this story through his Dan Rather type mannerisms.
Kind of feel like Dum Dum is actually the star.
Oh, yeah. I think so, too. Yeah, he's kind of the anchor that carries this along, which brings us to the great cattle rustlers storyline. So deep in Colorado, my neck of the woods, there's some cattle rustlers stealing. All right. Let me know if I get getting this right.
I'll definitely let you know.
So there's a prominent, is he a politician or a businessman he's a businessman who's going to lose.
He's a ranch owner.
So I thought they were trying to tie politics into this as well, but he's a ranch owner and there's rustlers trying to steal his cattle so that he loses everything and someone else can buy up his land. Is that it?
Something like that. Yeah. They want the land for some development or something.
Well, turns out Godzilla shows up to hassle the cattle rustlers who then proceed to try to rustle Godzilla.
There's at some point they're like, should we call in help from the superheroes or from the government? And they're like, no, we have 6 shooters and lassos. We can take him.
But they're lassoing his teeth and his tail and his, you know, and they're trying to ride on his head. This is great stuff. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen this. There is a movie. It's a Ray Harryhausen film called Valley of Gwangi. And that is about dinosaurs and cowboys. I'm pretty sure that inspiration must have been taken from that film. Because what are the odds of dinosaurs and cowboys just showing up randomly?
It's maybe in Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Maybe so. You might find this surprising, dear listener, but Godzilla is able to overcome the cattle rustlers. And he leads all the cattle back home. And the situation is saved. I love the fact, I mean, Godzilla's huge. How tall is he? He's just massive. Right?
Right.
And there's constantly people like, they'll be turning around a corner and go, whoa, what's that? He's huge. How did you not see that?
Or how did you not hear him?
Exactly. Yes. I mean,
did you not hear all the buildings falling?
Oh, man. But even if you're in a canyon, he's got a tower over top of all the mountains. So the people, you can see him coming. Again, suspension of disbelief, because it's fun stuff. And now we get to the final arc of the run, which is probably my favorite. And that is S.H.I.E.L.D. and Dum-Dum bring in Hank Pym to hit Godzilla with a shrinking gas so that Godzilla gets shrunken down into a manageable size. He put it in a cage, which is all well and fine until a scientist who's carrying the cage just happens to trip and fall.
And it should be noted that in their wisdom, after having learned the valuable lesson of the last time they captured Godzilla, taking him to a place with nuclear weapons, in their wisdom, they've decided to take the now captured Godzilla and bring him to New York City.
Well, yeah, but that's where all the superheroes are.
What could go wrong?
But come on, this is good stuff. Godzilla gets free. Right. Godzilla's a tiny little thing at this point. Little Zilla. Little Zilla.
Little fella.
And he gets loose and makes his way into the New York City sewers, where he meets a giant sewer. Well, not a giant, a regular sewer rat.
Which is probably giant.
Which is probably giant, exactly. This is my favorite fight scene of the entire thing, is Godzilla fights a sewer rat. And it's epic, I think.
Well, it's relatable.
It is. It is. I've been on the New York subway, and they could fight me for sure. Same. That in itself is fun. But little Rob goes out to try to find him, Godzilla, that is. And he does just happens to stumble upon Godzilla. He just walks past the sewer that he is in. And Godzilla hears his voice and comes out because they're friends. At which point, Godzilla, the shrinking gas, begins to wear off. And he grows to a human person's size. Where? Little Rob proceeds to disguise Godzilla by putting a hat and trench coat on him. And it's wonderful.
it is wonderful.
There are a couple of young thugs who want to attack them, but Godzilla whips off his coat and hat, and he takes on.
And thus dissuades them.
Yes, he hits them. He hits them with his atomic breath, and they run away screaming, "Ouch! I'm on fire!" And it's just a lovely moment. At this point, Dum-Dum and the S.H.I.E.L.D. team meet up with them on the docks. And there's this wonderful scene of them seeing Rob, like, wait, is that Rob? It looks like his walk, but who's that with him? Because Godzilla now has his trench coat and hat on again. I wonder who that fella is. At which point Godzilla disrobes again and then gets into a knockdown fight with Dum-Dum Dugan.
Which is...
I don't have words. It's so good.
No, there are no words. But I mean, you know, it's one of those great moments where it's, you know, you wouldn't have Dum-Dum and Godzilla wrestling with each other like if Godzilla was normal size, right? So, you
know, right. This is wonderful. I genuinely like this. Yeah, no, I genuinely like this arc. I genuinely like this story. Let's face it, Godzilla's at full size is a little unwieldy.
Right.
By shrinking him down to human size and having him interact with the characters is a genuinely good idea. And it works well. Just having a knockdown punch him out at human size.
Right.
Which continues on into the next section of this story where Godzilla goes to a museum because, sure, why not? And at that point, the Fantastic Four get involved and they head out to the museum to try to contain Godzilla.
Which leads to a scene with the Thing and Godzilla fighting each other in a tank full of sharks.
Well, first of all, they're on a walkway above a tank of sharks with no top on it. Call me crazy, but I'm thinking that in a public space, maybe put a lid on that shark tank, especially when it's over when it's just beneath a walkway. Look, I'm just thinking safety. This was the 70s. Maybe they didn't have the same.
There were less regulations. There was more freedom.
Yeah, there you go.
Freedom.
Freedom. Oh, make museums great again. But this also adds, this also has a scene of an interaction between Dum-Dum Dugan and the Thing insulting one another because Dum-Dum hates superheroes and the Thing is having nothing of it. So They insult each other about the quality of their cigars. And then
at one point, Trimpy like shows them both, and I think both cigars are like out of their mouths floating in the air.
It's you it's
know,
that
like the comic book, you know, the
that goink in the Yeah, that and during that back and forth, the thing also insults Dum Dum by saying he has the perfect name, and Dum Dum retorts with, yeah, this coming from a guy called The Thing. It's just good. I really enjoyed that interaction between those two. So,
well, this is really when the comic starts to, well, I mean, it started a long time ago, but this run up to the end, it just gets so
good. It's really a shame that what happened was that the license was not renewed for them to use it. And it wasn't because of low sales or because Toho objected. It's that Toho raised its rates and Marvel just said, no, they're not going to pay for it. This was it wasn't a huge seller, but it was a hit, and it sold.
It obviously sold well enough to go 24 issues.
It'd go 24 issues, exactly.
But for Marvel, it's like epic length before between, you know, a new number one or a cancellation.
Hey, this is the 70s. Comics used to run a long time back then. No, it actually did fairly well and would have continued if Marvel had just, well, they were in a financial downturn at this particular time. So it was a financial reason that they decided not to renew the license. It's just like I said, it's a shame because this was really hitting its stride at this point. I really think if this had gone...
Not the devil dinosaur yet.
I know. If this had gone a little bit longer, boy, the storylines... I mean, I was going to say the sky's the limit, but he's already been in space. So the Fantastic Four are able to... they're able to capture Godzilla because Reed Richards stretches himself out over his face and just takes the oxygen away from Godzilla so that he passes out. These are words that I'm saying out loud. These are more words that I'll be saying. They then take Godzilla back to the Baxter Building where they have Dr. Doom's time machine, which is a glowing square, and they send Godzilla back in time so that he can be with his in the rightful his time. Own people. His own people, his own time. He goes back in time. And of course, the first people he meets, Devil Dinosaur and Moon Boy, who then fight for a bit until they realize, oh, look, there's more people attacking us. And then they're friends and they fight together.
Right. Yeah. That sounds like a sort of thing that maybe could catch on. Like, you know, you get two groups fighting each other and then team up to fight the real bad guys.
I don't think that's viable.
No?
No, I don't think that'll ever catch on.
Yeah. Well, it was just an idea.
So once Devil Dinosaur and Godzilla have their epic team up, there is a problem with space and time, where Godzilla, of course, has to be thrust back to New York. I mean, it's obvious that a time machine created by Dr. Doom is not going to be reliable.
There was a problem because the radiation that Godzilla has is disrupted the time machine too, as it would.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I think we've never been able to figure out with our time machines the radiation problem.
Yes, well, you know, it is an ongoing flaw in all time machines. Well, Godzilla is brought back to the present, but at full size this time. So he's back to full size. He's in New York, and he's a little miffed.
He's cranky.
So he decides to go on a little bit of a rampage, which causes the Avengers to become a part of this whole storyline.
So at this point now we have the Avengers, Fantastic Four, the might of S.H.I.E.L.D., and J. Jonah Jameson involved.
There's a wonderful line about J. Jonah Jameson. Godzilla is passing the Daily Bugle. This is actually a great comedic scene.
So
J. Jonah Jameson is being J. Jonah with his back to the windows with Godzilla behind him, and there's someone in front of him going, oh, behind you. And J. Jonah,
go ahead.
J. Jonah, of course, turns around and decides to yell at Godzilla for you know, getting in his face.
Again, it's one of those great panels. You just have, it's pulled back and you just see Jameson, like, just with his head sticking out the window.
Raising his fist, just shaking his fist in Godzilla's face. And Godzilla does not use his atomic breath. He blows He blows what the line is. I wrote this down. He makes his sentiments known, just like J. Jonah Jameson, with a blast of hot air. And I just, you know, that's a chef's kiss. Mwah, what a beautiful scene that is. After this, the collected superheroes, the Avengers, Fantastic Four, and S.H.I.E.L.D. all try to lead Godzilla to the harbor and away from all the buildings. Because there's a very weird scene with the Empire State Building with Thor on one side and Godzilla on the other, just kind of squeezing it together. I don't know what the end goal of that was, but you know, it was they're saying they were playing tug of war with each other.
Yeah, it's well, Thor's trying to keep it upright, right? And Godzilla's trying to knock it down, and instead you have a mildly odd.
Yes, they're just sort of standing on either side, you know, pressing against the walls. But it is interesting that Mjolnir is the only thing that actually hits Godzilla that hurts him.
Right.
Gives you a little bit of insight into Thor's strength. But then the Wasp and Yellowjacket fly into Godzilla's ear canal in order to disorient him and make him fall down. You know what? I'll give him props. That's a clever idea.
Sure.
Sure. But Godzilla does fall into the harbor, but then rises out of the water and is about to run into this, you know, and just cause all kinds of damage when little Rob shows up and pleads with Godzilla to please just go away. And he does.
The end.
The end. There is actually a conclusion to this story. You know, I guess they knew the rights were going to leave and they were going to have to end this series. So there is a conclusion.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, Godzilla just dippy-doos out into the water and disappears under the water. And who knew all it took was little Rob just saying, hey, can you go away, please?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right, man. It was good.
All right, Rob. You haven't betrayed me in the last hour or anything. So
thanks, buddy.
Yeah.
And you know, they even managed to work in Spider-Man for 3 panels.
Yeah, Spider-Man has a little cameo to take a picture, which J. Jonah Jameson was yelling about. Where the hell is Parker? How come he's not taking pictures? So
because if you're going to utilize Spider-Man in a comic to like help sell issues, you definitely wait till the final issue and use him for 3 panels.
Yes. He does say, I'm a little late to this party. But so this is all really fun.
This is tremendous fun. And I think, like, again, you know, not to... In conclusion, I think you really hit it on the head earlier, just saying, you know, it's the first part is kind of you get through, and then as the comic continues on, I mean, obviously we're having a lot of fun describing it and talking about the silliness and whatever, but there were moments where I laughed out loud.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, this comic series is an anomaly. One of those strange blips in comic book history where a company gets the rights to something and tries to make it work as best they can. And luckily they had a creative team that they took it serious enough to make it look good, but they didn't take it that serious that they didn't have fun.
And that Marvel obviously, I think, had more success with some other like properties, obviously the Star Wars property.
Yeah, they got Star Wars. They were doing Planet of the Apes.
Right. And then subsequently, you know, it's like G.I. Joe and the Transformers a few years later into the 80s, which both were extremely successful.
They were the IDW of their day.
Yes. Yeah. We should do G.I. Joe at some point. But
I think this is the third podcast in a row where you've mentioned that.
Yeah.
Just recommend G.I. Joe, for God's sakes. No, I think, look, I wouldn't say this comic is good, in quotes, but it is something that I enjoy a whole heck of a lot. It's just straight up fun.
It's not good, but it's kind of great.
Yes, exactly.
I am really, really happy you recommended this. I was good. Very, very skeptical at first. I was like, oh my God, you want me to read 24 issues of Godzilla?
Yes, we had discussed this before I recommended it. And I said, you know, you got to get to the back half for it to get good. I know you didn't believe me at first, but this is something I read this as a kid. So I remember reading this from my youth. my misspent youth from the spitter racks at Wawa. So it was really fun to reread this. And I still just get so much joy from silly stuff like this.
Yeah. Well, and again, we've said this a million times. We'll probably say it a million times more. It's like, it's comics. It's fun. This is not grim and gritty, serious stuff. Oh, no. This is exactly what, as kids, we loved about comics. And then reading as an adult, when we're catching some of the different nuances and being able to notice different things about it, and also to appreciate the ridiculousness, and I mean that as like appreciate the ridiculousness as opposed to like some pretension about it.
Right. And there are Godzilla stories still being written in comics, and a lot of them take themselves so seriously. And they're good for them for what they're trying to be. That's all well and fine. But this was just embracing the absolute weirdness of a giant monster in a superhero story. And like you said, I do appreciate the creative team, you know, Monk and Trimpy, just giving it their all. Taking a ridiculous assignment and saying, hey, how can we make this good? And they succeeded in my eyes.
I believe so as well.
All right. Well, that's it for this particular comic book. Brian, on an all-new episode of the Collected Edition, what do we got?
Well, I've dithered and deliberated. So there's a few options that I was kind of looking at, but I think some of these are going to have to wait for future episodes. And during my search for certain comics that I wanted to cover, I ran across and remembered Dreadstar by Jim Starlin.
Woohoo.
Yeah. Yeah. Which was the very first Epic comic, Marvel's Epic line. Now, there is a comic that Epic put out that is maybe one of the greatest comics ever made. And someday we'll get to that. We've mentioned it before. But for next time around, I kind of want to go back and reread Dreadstar.
I think that's great because I don't think I've read this. So
it has been a long time since I read it.
I know. I mean, I know the look of it.
I loved it at the time. It was the mature readers thing because it was on Epic. But, it's Jim Starlin. I mean, who doesn't love Jim Starlin, right?
It's Jim Starlin doing space stuff. So how bad could it be?
I mean, it's not like he, you know, doesn't have experience in that realm. So I am recommending this not with any strong knowledge. I am recommending this because I kind of want to reread it. And I want to force the rest of you to go on this journey with me.
Excellent. Well, I do want to go on this journey because this is new to me and this is exciting stuff.
So I am recommending the first 12 issues. It's actually collected as the Dreadstar Omnibus number one. And it's issue 1 through 12.
This is really exciting stuff. All right. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Please, love to hear your comments on Godzilla. I'd love to hear your comments on your selling of Grit and any other ads in comic books. And just, you know, your basic comments in general. So visit our website at collectededitionpodcast.com and hit us up on Twitter at collectededpod, collectededpod. Maybe I will update our Instagram again someday, which I haven't done in a while. You never know. But so until next time, thanks everybody, and keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the program are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. If you'd like to give us your feedback, the show can be found online at our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes, or send us an email to comments@collectededitionpodcast.com. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
By the way, Godzilla versus Kong, awesome.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it's.
I mean, if you're looking, if you're looking for something like story or characters or a plot, that's not really good. But if you're looking for two giant monsters punching each other, it's awesome. It's so good. I watched it and just went, yay.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, they're jumping on aircraft carriers. Yay. Yeah. See, that's another thing. If you're looking for physics, it's not going to happen.
Not the right, yeah. So, I do, before we close it out, and, you know, if we'll see if you delete this or not, but I would like to encourage anybody out there. I want to give Herb Trimpe credit. I know we kind of picked on a little bit, but we also have mentioned several scenes that that he did that were quite good. And I really want to give him a special shout out for issue 14, page 17, the third panel. I will let folks investigate that on their own, but Mr. Trimpe is a dirty, dirty, dirty man.
It's a man playing with his joystick.
And I couldn't let this go without without at least giving that panel a passing mention.
It is, I don't think it was intentional, but I do think...
I think it was.
Okay. I was going to give Trimpe the benefit of the doubt and just say... It happens to look provocative. anyway, hope everyone's curious enough. Go check it out.